Welcome to the Crack House Chronicles, your favorite true crime podcast. I am Donnie, and with me is a man that wants everyone to know that vegetable pizza is just a salad with a side of bread. That's Dale.
Yeah, I don't know that trash.
Yeah.
Get that garden out here.
Yeah, we don't want a vegetable pizza.
No. I'll eat a salad. No, I'll eat a pizza. Don't mix them up.
Yeah. Okay, just the long debate of all time. Does pineapple go on pizza?
Oh, yeah, I'll eat it on there.
You will?
Yeah. I'll do it. No salad, though.
No salad on the pizza?
No. It's like my girls come home with a pizza and some breadsticks. I'm like, so you got some bread to go with your bread?
Yeah.
Sorry, you got breadsticks all the way around it. Why you need more breadsticks?
You just got to have more bread.
Yeah. It's just bread with your bread. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it works for me.
Yeah, I'll do pineapple on pizza.
But if they're bringing pizza home, you don't complain about it.
No.
Mm-mm.
Batman won't eat.
That's right. What's going on today, dude?
You, man. Same old.
Same old. You got any good shout-outs or anybody you want to talk about?
Oh, man, you know it.
Bring it on.
Hey, look at that. Ooh. We have ourselves an Apple Podcast
five-star.
Five-star review right here from HST 2022. Says, love this show. I love you guys like a stripper loves a Benny. How about that, Don?
Oh, man.
Can't wait to hear your episodes every week. I also support you on Patreon, and I love you guys.
Oh,
so, man. How about that?
Well, we love you.
Man, we love a Patreon supporter. How about that?
We do.
So we really appreciate that. Thanks for taking the time to actually go out there and give us a five-star review and putting something in the box so we can shout you out. And thanks so much for being a Patreon supporter. That means the world. Thanks so much.
It really does. If anybody wants to be like HTS, and go to Apple Podcasts, click that five-star, and write something in the box, and you'll get a shout-out.
You'll get one.
That's how it works.
Right here.
On this show, anyway.
Free of charge.
Yep.
Yeah.
We don't charge a thing for it.
No. Heck no.
Mm-mm.
We like it.
We do. We like it a lot. And if you want to go to the store page, it's still time to get you a hoodie or a long-sleeve T-shirt for winter.
Yeah, you just got you one, did you?
I did. I ordered me a new one.
Fancy.
Yeah, I like it.
I'm about to get me one. Mine's about wore out.
Yeah, I like them. They're very comfortable, and they will keep you warm this winter.
Warm.
Yep. There's several to choose from, and just go check them out.
I don't know why you didn't buy a tank top, much you like being cold.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll put up my sweaters and get out my other sweaters.
Yeah.
And get out my V-neck sweaters.
Yeah, it's like in my house. I go home today and get out of the car, go in the house, dump the coat on and go in the house.
Yep. All right, dude, we're going to get going this episode.
All righty.
We got a strange case, man.
We've had a doozy.
Yeah. And researching this, I didn't think it would go where it was going to go, but it did. Well, and it's pretty crazy.
And there it went.
Yeah.
How about that?
It is went and gone. We're going to talk about it. But our story that we're talking about starts on November the 7th of 1992.
Okay.
Yeah. And this is where a lady by the name of Angela Brasso, she was just about to turn 22 years old.
Yeah. The next day, actually.
Yeah. And she had worked that day, and she was pretty tired. She had been preparing for a conference and training she was going to give the next day.
Yeah, she was young, but she was extremely brilliant.
Yes. And just a little bit of background on her. She grew up in Pennsylvania and decided to go to technical school.
DeVry.
Yeah, out in California.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And after graduating there, she landed a job at Centelect. This is an IT company, Dale, that created a piece of software that would allow banks to have customers to be able to call in and retrieve their balance or account information over the phone.
It was like a voice recognition kind of thing.
Yeah.
Where they talk back to you. So you can call and see what your balance was, and they would tell it to you.
Over the phone.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was pretty. I remember when that happened.
Right, yeah.
It was very cool.
But she was very young. She was only going to be 22 on her birthday.
Mm-hmm.
So she had really taken to this thing and figured it out good and was getting ready to start doing classes and teaching other folks.
How to use this technology.
Yeah. Extremely advanced for 1992.
It was. But this evening of November the 7th, you know, like I say, she'd had a long day, and she got home and she wanted to go ride on her bike.
Yeah.
And there in Arizona, where this is taking place, she rode her bike around the Arizona Canal.
Yeah.
It's a pretty popular recreational area for cyclists and joggers and anybody wanting to get out and about around town.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's like a cement river kind of.
Yeah. Like you see on Terminator 2.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Kind of sort of like that. That's what I thought about when I saw it.
Yep. But she was out riding her bike at night, and she left her live-in boyfriend back at the apartment.
He was going to stay home and make her a cake for her birthday the next day.
Very cool.
Which is kind of cool.
Yeah, but she was out riding her bike, and it kept getting later and later, and she hadn't come home.
Yeah, usually she's back in time to watch her favorite TV show, and I never did see what that is, but I did hear that several places.
Yeah.
But so it's kind of like, you know, it was back in, it wasn't a DVR, or I'll catch it later or stream it. You either saw it or you didn't.
Yeah.
Unless you had the VCR going, of course.
Yeah, you just had to catch it that time. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. But she hadn't come home, and he got worried, and he went out looking for her on his bike.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Actually, he went out 3 different times.
Yeah.
Yeah. So and he was pretty tore up about it.
And at some point during those times, or it may have been after that third time, he'd called her mother back in Pennsylvania to tell her what was going on and that Angela hadn't come home for the night.
Yeah, and she was worried to death now.
Yeah. Just a little bit later, he called, I guess, authorities, police, or somebody to come out.
Yeah, or just let them know what was going on. She's
missing. Yeah, she hadn't come home. So going into the next day, you know, Angela was supposed to give this training.
Yeah. And it was her big day. I mean, she'd been working for this really, really, really hard.
I think for about 4 months.
Yeah.
Preparing for this training.
And he said part of the reason she went out to ride the bike that night, I mean, it's something she did a lot, but something good, she can go out and clear her head and get stuff ready so she could be fresh for the next day.
And I get that, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just got to get out and burn it off.
Mm-hmm. But she had planned for this meeting, this training, for about 4 months.
Yeah, had people coming in from all over, you know.
All over the country.
Yeah, it wasn't just a little thing. This is a big deal.
Yeah. And that morning when the training was about to start, She wasn't at work.
No. Mm-mm. She didn't show up.
And everybody was looking around, you know, what are we going to do? What are we going to do?
Right.
And luckily, one of her coworkers there filled in for her.
Yeah.
And took over. And
yeah, the class got taught, you know, in some capacity.
And it was some point during that morning, one of her coworkers was there at work, and she was standing next to her desk, and Angela's desk was right next to hers.
Right.
And the phone rung, and she just happened to pick it up.
Yeah.
Because Angela wasn't there.
Right. So just by instinct, she just grabbed the phone.
Yeah, and it was Angela's mother looking for her.
Right.
And told her that she hadn't come into work. Mm. And then that had sent chills all over your body.
Oh, yeah.
I can't imagine.
Yeah, because she's missing, you know, and then you call work the next day, and she's still not here.
So the police are out looking, trying to find out what happened to Angela.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they're talking to Mr. Boyfriend.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure they took him in.
His name was Joe, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, but when they were in the apartment there getting information from him, the authorities, they had looked in the sink and saw a knife there with some red stuff on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to know how, can you explain this?
Yeah. And it's like birthday cake icing.
Yep. Yeah. Well, they also was kind of looking at him a little sideways, too, because they had also heard that he had another lady had come over to the house the night before.
Yes.
His explanation was that he just didn't want to be alone.
Yeah, so that didn't make him look good at all.
No, because they was probably thinking he was wanting somebody to come over and lick the beater.
Yeah, because he was making a cake.
He was making a cake.
Yeah. I remember licking the beaters as a kid.
Yeah.
The next morning, police were searching for Angela.
Yes.
And they happened to come up on Angela's body in a field next to her apartment, and she had been fatally stabbed in the back, sexually assaulted, and decapitated. But her head was nowhere to be found.
Right.
Just her body.
Yeah, still can't find it.
No.
Yeah, she had been pretty ravaged.
Yeah.
Also, her bike was missing.
Yes.
We don't know where that was.
And her bike was her pride and joy.
Yeah, it was a purple mountain bike.
Yes. And it was 11 days later, Angela's head was spotted in the Arizona Canal, about 2 miles from where her body had been found.
Well, it was kind of found by a guy they called King Fisher, and they called him that because he was known to be out there fishing in the canals and stuff, and if they had fish in them, I have no idea. But apparently he was fishing in them, and then he came up on it and called it in.
Mm-hmm.
And they said it was really odd because it looked really, I want to say, fresh.
But the decomposition wasn't the same as the body.
Right. It was almost none. Like it had been kept in the refrigerator for like the last 10 days, and then somebody just decided to dump it.
Get rid of it in the canal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or either that, or I'm going to put it out here for shock factor in the canal. Because it was like found on a drain grate. It wasn't actually in the water.
Yeah.
Right.
But everybody reports it being in the canal, but it was actually on a drain grate, like you said.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So at this time, Angela's case went cold, man. I mean, they had nothing to go on.
Yeah.
And it was about 10 months later, this was on September the 22nd of 1993, a 17-year-old girl by the name of Melanie Burness, she was a high school student at Arcadia High School there in Phoenix.
Right, which is kind of famous.
Yeah, it is. She took an evening bike ride.
Yeah, her mother had been out on a dinner date and she came back, and she noticed that Melody was not home, and so she's kind of pissed off because it was way past curfew.
Yes.
But then she got to looking around and noticed that Melody and her bike were also gone, so she assumed that she had been gone out on a bike ride as well.
Now, it was the next morning. There was a Phoenix woman. Her name was Charlotte Pottle.
Right.
And she was riding her bike with her daughter in the back seat, kind of like one of them seats attached to the bicycle. I guess you can ride a toddler in.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah. She was riding that seat, and she rode through a strange-looking puddle.
Yeah, it was kind of weird, for especially in Arizona.
You know, yeah.
There's not going to be a lot of puddles around.
That's right. And it was reported they went to a swing set and played on the playground and done some things. Then she went back to the puddle.
Well, that really was nagging at her. She just didn't understand what was the deal with this.
What was that? Yeah.
This puddle.
It looked dark when she rode over it.
Right, and actually rode through it.
Yeah.
It actually splashed, you know, a little bit on her. And so she decided they would, when they would turn around and go back home, when they were going back, the sun was to her back, so she could actually see it a little more and noticed that it looked really like it was red.
Yeah.
So she was like, it's surely not. So she stopped, got off her bike, and had her sister hold her bike while she went over and inspected it. And actually, it looked like blood to her.
Yeah.
And then she noticed some drag marks. And she started looking, and the drag marks kind of went to the left from where she was standing, which is the opposite way than the canal water, because this is also on right there, canal. And it went down and then kind of like of around of a tree a little bit. And there was another little puddle over there. And then the drag marks went back across the road and then into the canal.
Yes.
So she just had chills all over when she seen them drag marks. She didn't know what to do. She's like, And like, it was no cell phone.
And she didn't know what to do. So yeah. She just went home.
She went home and called the cops.
Yes.
Yes.
Which was commendable for her. She could have just wrote it off and just.
Well, it was kind of commendable at first. And then she said that once she got home, she got a call from detectives. And they said, where are you at? She said, I'm at home. She goes, well, you stay right there. We're on our way over there. And said that she said that when they showed up to her door, they was basically saying she did it.
Yeah.
She goes, what do you mean? I was the one who called in. I discovered it. He goes, no, we see your feet are all over around those drag marks. We think you did it. And mm-hmm. She's like, hell no. But anyway, so they finally left. And she said that later she would end up saying that she was just distraught over this because they come in and accused her of this, and she thought they was coming to arrest her any time, and then they never called her back.
Yeah. Just
left her hanging that over her head for months.
Every day they could show up and arrest me.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's kind of shitty, I think.
But the police did go out to the scene there at the canal.
Oh, for sure.
And they found Melanie's body. It was floating in the canal.
Right where them drag marks went in.
Yes. And it was weird, too, because she was dressed in what was described as a blue bodysuit.
Yeah.
But I've seen pictures of it, and to me it looks more like a one-piece bathing suit.
Yeah, so I'm thinking it's maybe something like you would wear over your leotards if you were doing aerobics back in the day.
But or ballet or something like
but
that.
But it definitely does look like a one-piece bathing suit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's basically what it looks like. I don't know why people call it a bodysuit, but...
Maybe that's a technical name.
It could be, yeah. This was not her bodysuit.
No.
Mm-mm. They later found out that... It had been put on her.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever killed her.
Her clothes had been discarded, and this had been put on her. They're thinking postmortem.
Yeah. But Melanie had been fatally stabbed in the back and sexually assaulted.
Yes.
Now, this was what was weird. A matching DNA profile was found on both victims, Angela and Melanie.
Mm-hmm.
And their murders became known as the Canal Murders.
Oh, yes. So all they know is basically they're thinking this is the same guy.
But the case did go cold.
Yep.
And there were tips coming in all over the world. People trying to find out who this canal murderer was, yeah, Dale.
What could happen or who could it be.
But yeah.
It just went cold, and it would stay cold until decades.
Yeah. Because we're moving up to 2011.
Right.
And this was a Phoenix police detective. His name was Clark Schwarzkopf.
Yes.
Yeah. And he was working with the cold case unit investigating these canal murders.
Yeah, he was taking this over, and he's like, he was going for the big one.
Yeah, he was trying to find out what happened to these two girls.
Yeah, so he went in and talked to them, basically saying, you know, this is what he was doing. He wanted to take on this case, and he wanted to see what they could find out. And that's when they basically say, well, here's the list. There's over 600 people on this list.
And he's like, people of interest.
Yeah, he said, well, okay, well, give it to me. Let's get started. We'll start at the bottom, or we'll start at A and just go all the way through it.
Yeah.
He said, that's all I know how to do.
That's all he ever done.
Yeah. So that's what they started doing, going through his stuff. And then they noticed that they had actually had talked to like over 800 people. And he said this room was just full of case files.
Mm-hmm.
So his basically the way he was going to handle this thing is back in the day they had, you know, the DNA stuff that they had got from a few people, but there was a bunch that they never got. So while they were going through all these lists and anything that they seen pertinent, they were going and trying to find these people wherever they were now and then find a DNA profile from them.
Yes.
Or see if I could get some DNA from them people. Even that, that meant putting detectives on airplanes and flying them anywhere they could find somebody.
Yes. That's what they were doing.
Yeah. So they was, he was really putting a lot of effort in them. It was a lot of money too, but trying to figure out what the hell was going on here.
I know. But you know, up to this time, they were some suspects. Even the professor that Angela had at DeVry in California.
Yeah.
He was a...
Well, it was reported that maybe he had a crush
on her. Yeah.
He
was actually ex-military, a colonel special forces or a major special forces, something like that. He was pretty high ranked. And
they thought maybe it was like a professional, either a surgeon or maybe somewhere, like you said, that was in, you know, a high military or ex-military or somebody that knew what they were doing.
Had some combat training.
Yeah, combat training. So those folks went to the top of the list for sure.
Yeah, they did. And the lady that reported the blood spot there, she was a suspect.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got Angela's boyfriend.
Yep. All these people.
I mean, yeah.
In the list of 600, there's a whole lot more, but that just gives you some of the top players.
That's right. So we're moving into late 2014.
Mm-hmm.
And this was when the investigators in these cases, they were at a conference. And there was a lady there by the name of Colleen Fitzpatrick. She was a forensic genealogist. But the name of her company is Identifiers International. And they developed the software that could actually mine out public genealogy databases.
Right. You know, like the 23andMe and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. This was way ahead of its time.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
This is groundbreaking. This is this is where it all started.
Yeah. And they were searching for matches to crime scene DNA.
Yes.
And she approached the investigators asking them if she could help with solving this case.
Right, because it's not like you usually do. I mean, they put it in CODIS and all that stuff to try to find it, but nothing ever came up.
Yeah.
But she didn't look at it that way. She went in a whole different way.
She wanted to find out who this DNA's family was, the
right.
family tree.
Exactly. Not necessarily I'm going to tell you it was this person or that person, but I can give you pretty much the family and maybe even a last name if we can get it close enough to give you something to go on.
Yeah. And the investigators, they pondered over this for a while. They didn't want to do it.
They didn't want to do it because they didn't want to bring anybody in that wasn't pertinent to the investigation. They didn't want to give out what they had.
But all she was going to get is a DNA sequence.
Yeah, she didn't want, that's what she said, she didn't want none of that stuff. All she wanted was that, you know, but they still had to give up the only DNA that they had taken off those two bodies.
Yes. But eventually, they decide to sign off on it and give Colleen Fitzpatrick these DNA.
Yeah. Well, they said that the upper end didn't want to spend the money.
That's right.
Because it was going to be expensive. And then, basically, the guys that were all on the cold case team were like, look, we're spending all this money flying people everywhere. I mean, we're not. This is kind of a win-win. There's no downside to this. Why wouldn't we do it? And said that, actually, they had even considered taking up
out of their own pocket.
Everybody chip in and do it ourselves.
Yeah.
Go rogue on it and do it ourselves. But eventually, one of the higher-ups went ahead and signed off on it and said, you know, what the hell, we ain't got nothing to lose.
That's right. Not at this point, because this case is cold.
Yeah.
They
been cold.
But they did give the code to Colleen and didn't hear back from him for a while.
Wasn't a while, yeah. And
yeah, it was like, several months.
Maybe we made a wrong mistake here.
Yeah, didn't hear nothing from her, so they didn't know what was going on. And she came back.
Yep.
And she told Schwarzkopf that she had a surname.
Yep.
They came up with a surname, and his name was Miller. His
name's going to be Miller.
Yeah.
So he called detectives, and they went down and pulled all the boxes that had anything to do with Miller on them and brought them up and put them on his desk.
And they found six people in their files with the last name Miller.
Mm-hmm. They said Miller was a pretty common name there.
Yeah. So just to narrow it down to six, that's really good.
Yeah, real good.
Yeah.
Out of 600?
Yeah, very good, yeah. That they talked to, yeah.
Yes.
And they got to looking through it, and they found a file that was about a half inch thick.
Mm-hmm.
And on the file, the man's name was Brian Patrick Miller.
Right. And it was wrote, anonymous tip.
Yes.
Was written on it.
Yeah. And this anonymous tip was regarding the bodysuit.
Yes.
Yeah, that they had seen it in his possession at one time.
Yes, yeah. Somebody said that they had saw that in his apartment or something.
Yeah.
At one time.
His house that we're going to talk about.
Yeah, said it was really weird that it actually had seen that he had that.
And this tip stayed on that file for years.
Yeah, and with a lot of other stuff. So once they got into it, they started looking at the background and kind of was taken aback about what they found in his background.
So just a little bit of background on Brian Patrick Miller. His father was Paul Miller, and he had died in 1977. And we'd read this in several places different, but it was reported that he had died in a motorcycle accident.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
At a very young age. And his mother, her name was Donna Grimmer, and she remarried several times after Paul's death.
Mm-hmm.
And she worked as a detention officer with the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office.
Right. And reportedly, she kind of run her household like it was the detention center.
Yeah. She come home and it was the same thing.
Yeah. She started beating him when he was five, he says. Now we don't know.
Yeah, that's what he reported later on, that she was physically abusive, psychologically abusive, and
sexually abusive.
Yeah, a lot of things.
I don't know if she was doing anything directly to him, but she would walk around the house mostly naked, and they said reportedly gave him adult magazines when he was really young, like 10 years old, and just weird stuff like that.
Yeah. But Patrick, he also had a brother, David, who was arrested for minor offense in 2014. And his DNA sample was used by the police to find a partial match with the DNA from the canal murder scene. So that was one of the leads that they had had in their database to link him to Patrick.
Yeah. And then once they dug in a little deeper, they also see that Mr. Miller had a juvenile record.
Yes, he did.
And this would be coming into the case of Celeste Bentley.
Yeah.
Now, Celeste was a Phoenix woman who she was working at a mall there, right?
Yes, she was.
And she usually took the bus because it was just right the road from where she lived. So she always rode the bus to work. It saved a lot of hassle. And said she was riding the bus one morning. She noticed this younger kid.
So he was geeky looking.
A little geeky kid. Yeah, about 16 years old. You know, sitting on the same bus. No big deal. She acknowledged him, went on about her business. So they got to the place where she got off, and she got off at the mall and was walking through the parking lot. So it was pretty early. So not a lot of people there, and I don't know if it's one of them underground parking lots or what, but anyway.
She was walking to the mall.
Yeah, she was going bus stop. To like a back entrance to the mall where she worked. And she kind of noticed, you know, she was walking that somebody was walking behind her a little bit. So she kind of turned and looked and noticed it was that same geeky kid that was on the bus. And she didn't really think much about it, you know. She must have just got off the same place as me, and here we go. Well, then all of a sudden, he just kind of runs up, and she thought just punched her in the back and then run back. She turned around and yelled at him, like, what are you doing? And so she turned around, and she stuck her hand back, and then when she pulled her hand back around to the front from her back, there's a lot of backs, then she saw blood.
Yes.
And then she kind of started to freak out.
Yeah, and then she headed toward her workplace there in the mall.
Yeah, so she ran up and started knocking on the back door because they had to come let her in. So she starts ringing, and finally the assistant manager come and opened the door. And she started freaking out because she was bleeding all over the place. So
yeah.
They took her in and called the cops.
Yep. And they got there, and they were working on her, trying to get her straightened out and get her set up.
Yeah. First responders pulled in, and they had her. She was in the ambulance.
Yeah.
They were trying to. Said that it was about an inch and a half gash. It was about an inch and a half to 2 inches deep.
Yeah. Pretty bad, though,
pretty
really.
Good. Yeah.
But they were in the ambulance working on her, and the cops showed up, and they had a guy with them.
Yeah, she told them what he looked like, and they wasn't going long. They come back and brought a guy up to him and said, is this him?
Put him up to the back door.
Yeah,
that's pretty good.
Yeah, that's kind of freaky to me.
And she did identify the guy that stabbed her.
Yeah, and it was Mr. Miller.
It was. And just keep in mind, he was 16 years old at
the
time.
He was 16.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he was charged with aggravated assault, and I was thinking attempted murder, but I'm not sure. Anyway, him being that young, he was sent to juvenile detention where he stayed there until he was about 18.
Yeah, and when he got out of juvenile detention, his mom didn't want him coming home.
Well, she
found some stuff.
Well, when they were cleaning out his room, they found some stuff, and it was a pretty disturbing. I've heard it was a note, and I've heard it was some other stuff, but it was basically a thing called the plan. And it had basically spelled out how he wanted to find, abduct, rape, and murder, and dismember a young woman and preserving her head.
Yes.
So her mom actually had turned this note in to the police department saying that when he got out, she did not want him to come back to her house. Therefore, he had to go to a halfway house.
That's
when
right.
He came out. And speaking of the plan, the copy of this plan was also in his folder. When they dug out the cold case folders.
Yes.
So we got this stabbing thing, the plan, and all this is right on the thing that they've had this whole time.
Yeah, they've been sitting on it
the whole time. So that's pretty pretty wild to me.
They probably just didn't link them two together, because when these two girls were killed in 92 and 93, Patrick Miller was pretty young.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the ways they ruled him out. It didn't connect him with the – he just didn't fit the profile of what would
– Right. Well, you know, I think they kind of got sidetracked looking for a surgeon type or someone like with knife experience, an older guy with a military experience or something like that. I think they were focused in on that.
Because at one point, they even went to the local Air Force base there, and they were pulling guys' names that were, I guess – serving at that base at that time.
Yeah. And then trying to find them too.
Yeah.
And, they could be anywhere in the world, you know, because people that stay on those kind of bases, they're there for a while and then they could be gone somewhere else in 6 months, you know.
Yeah, but they were focused on, like you said, military or surgeon, somebody with skills.
Yes.
Knife skills. Mm-hmm. That's what they were looking for. So he just didn't fit the profile at all.
Well, basically they were doing it. I think a big part of that is because both of the girls that were attacked on a bicycle were stabbed in the back. And basically where it was stabbed, it pretty much decapacitated them right off the bat.
Yeah.
I mean, and maybe even killed them with that one shot. And Celeste, the lady who was stabbed at the mall, said that they had told her if he had turned the knife the other way, if it had been horizontal instead of vertical, it would might have done her the same way. So he was just maybe practicing here because he's really young.
That's right.
Because it hit her ribs and stopped. Otherwise, it would have went on through, you know, if it would have been flat.
Golly.
So she's really lucky, even though it was a pretty severe stabbing.
If it had been different, I mean, she could have bled out right there.
Oh, yeah. She could have been number one,
mm-hmm.
as far as we know.
Now, just a little bit more background on Brian Patrick Miller. He got married in 2000. He married a lady by name of Amy Miller. So I guess that was her name after she got married. But he had met her at a Comic-Con convention.
Right.
And they ended up having a daughter by the name of Sarah, who was born in 2001.
Mm-hmm. And then they moved, actually, to Washington State.
Yes, they did.
And I think it was close to where his mother lived, actually, which is kind of odd to me. But so they moved out there for a while.
Yeah, because she didn't want him back home after he got out of the juvie.
Well, I guess, she could probably be scared of him now if he's straight and narrow now. You know.
Yeah.
Maybe he's thinking he was just bad off being in that halfway house and all that stuff. So, or in the juvie, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
And then they moved out there for a while. And I don't know how long they were out there, and then they moved back to this area.
Phoenix, Arizona, yeah. That's right. But Amy, his wife, said about Brian Patrick that he was a loving father and husband at first.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, but then he became kind of abusive and controlling over time.
Yeah.
And she even said that he had a collection of knives and swords.
Yeah.
Which he often used during sex. But while they were in Washington State, Dale, it was in 2002, there was a woman named Melissa Ruiz Ramirez, and she was walking down the street in Everett, Washington.
Right.
And somebody pulls over, and it was Brian Patrick Miller. And Ruiz Ramirez would later tell police she'd seen him before, talking to some friends of hers.
Mm-hmm.
And she also said she got into Miller's car and told him that she needed to make a call. And he drove her to his workplace so she could use the phone. And she tells the police later on the phone, from out of the clear blue sky, Brian Patrick Miller comes running out with a 12-inch serrated knife and stabs her in the back.
Yeah.
And they get to fighting over the knife.
And she runs out. She
yes. Away. She escapes and she contacts the police.
Yes.
And they picked up Miller shortly after.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't deny stabbing her.
No.
But he claimed it was
self-defense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he said he was at work when Melissa Ramirez walked in off the street and asked to make a call. And then all of a sudden, she pulled out a knife and tries to rob him with the knife.
Yeah.
And Miller was arrested and charged with first-degree assault with a deadly weapon and was jailed from May 2002 until December trial.
Yeah. So that's quite a while.
Quite a while to stay in jail.
Just waiting.
But the jury, they didn't buy Melissa's story at all.
No. He got acquitted.
Yeah, they got acquitted of all the charges.
It's another typical hand slapper on a serial, or I guess I would say serial killer, but on a killer.
Yeah. So
they all have a chance to pick them up and then...
Let them go. Yeah. That's what happens. But you know, Dale, the whole time that Patrick Miller was in jail from May to December, waiting his trial to get acquitted, He was writing letters back and forth to his wife.
Yeah, and telling her what he was going to do. So he was getting a lot darker as he sat in jail from...
I guess he had time to think.
A lot. And his little switch flipped, I guess.
Yeah, his little warped mind.
Yeah, he's becoming very, very sexual deviant.
Yeah.
And telling her, writing her letters, telling her what he's going to do to her and what stuff he's going to do when he gets out and all this stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when he did finally get acquitted of this stabbing, Amy said he was a dark sexual deviant. It was a side she had never seen before.
Yeah.
And there were times where there was sex between them, and he held a knife to her throat.
He'd hold a knife to her throat, and he would tie her up without her consent, and he would, like, stick her with pins, all kind of pins and stuff. And I said a lot of times, I said, well, did you ever, you know, say anything to him? She goes, no, because she was scared of him. And she said, you know, I was just hoping that maybe he loved me enough not to kill me.
Yeah.
I was like, whoa.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, he was getting a little crazy there.
Yeah. And Amy, his wife, even told Schwarzkopf that her husband claimed something happened to him as a kid. Yeah. Something that would become like the cornerstone for his murdering Angela Brasso and Melanie Bernis.
Yeah.
Everybody was saying that his mom had created a monster.
Yeah. Blame it on mama.
Yeah, that's what he did. Now, when they got to looking into Brian Patrick Miller, they realized that he was some kind of local celebrity.
Yeah, it wasn't hard to find.
No.
That's for sure.
No, because he was known around town as the zombie hunter.
Yes.
He had a modified police car that he rode around in.
Yeah, it was an old retired police car that he had gotten, like you said, modified it up. He had, like, steel bars across the windshield. Instead of blue lights on it, he had, like, green lights or green and orange lights, maybe, and zombie hunter on the door and fake blood running down the doors, and even had bars on the back windows, and actually had a full-size zombie mannequin
in the back seat.
And even going as far as wearing like this big trench coat thing with this mask, like a steampunk type mask. And so he was pretty famous around there. He was like, he would go to all the zombie runs and the comic cons and this kind of stuff. So a lot of people knew who he was.
Parades and everything.
Right.
Yeah. So he was like, kind of like, they would see this car around town. They knew who it was.
Yeah, it was his daily driver. He didn't just take it to comic con.
He drove it at work.
Yeah, he drove it everywhere.
Yeah.
He even drove it to his job at the Amazon packing warehouse or whatever you call it.
Yeah.
Distribution center.
Yeah, that was his job. That was his car he rode around
in. His daily driver.
That's right.
Yeah.
This is crazy.
Yeah, we'll post pictures of this thing. It's actually a pretty cool car. I wonder where it is now.
I don't know, but he was big into this steampunk stuff.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he would portray these characters at night as some kind of subculture that deals in with this Victorian era technology.
Yeah.
It's the way they, and everything's powered by steam.
Right.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
But he dressed up in all these costumes and outfits that he made himself.
Right. So he wasn't really hard to find because everybody knew who he was once they put the name with the zombie killer or zombie hunter, I'm sorry. Once they, you know, put the two together, well, this is who we're looking for. So everybody's like, well, hell, I see him driving around everywhere. So that's how they started putting some surveillance on Mr. Miller.
Because
they knew they could find out who he was, but the only way they could prove anything this time is if they could maybe grab his DNA or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I'm sure they wasn't going to just walk up and get it to him. So they started following him around.
They did.
And keep him under surveillance.
So this Detective Schwarzkopf, he started to conduct surveillance on Patrick Miller.
Yep.
And he would sit out in a parking lot at his work, and he would observe him on breaks, sitting out in his car, listening to loud, some obnoxious music is what he called it.
Yeah, I'd like to know what it was. I'd probably like it.
Yeah. And he was just hoping he would throw something out of the car.
Right, but he didn't ever throw anything away. He'd just come out, take his break, go back in the car. Back in the building, and then come out at lunch. Same thing. Over and over. And they followed him around for a while, and they just could never get anything.
No, he knew not to throw something away that had his DNA on.
Or he just kept everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Which we're going to get into.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they come up with a pretty clever idea. They were going to try to get, I guess, Patrick into their folds by giving him a job proposal.
Yeah, one of the detectives come up and said, listen, we can't get nothing, and if he can play a little role, why can't we play a role? He said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, I'm just going to go up to him and say I'm a security consultant.
Out there in the parking lot at work.
Yeah, because he said, and I'm going to say that basically we're with this warehouse that's across the street here, and we want to hire you to keep an eye on what's going on over here, and we'd like to talk to you about it and, you know, pay you $20 an hour and see if that's something you'd be interested in.
Yeah.
So he just jumped all over
that. Yeah, he took the bait.
Yeah. So they wanted him to meet him so they could fill out an application and they could have like a little interview and see if it was something they really wanted to do.
Yeah.
So what they did is they hired him, or called him to have him come into Chili's. They were going to go meet at a restaurant, the local Chili's here.
So it was at this point, Dale, they was trying to get Brian Patrick Miller's DNA.
Yeah.
And one of the detectives, he went in there and he talked to the manager, and the manager agreed to do all this.
The manager even agreed to be the waiter.
He did.
Or waitress, whatever, the server.
Yes.
So I'm not sure which way that goes.
Yeah. And they sterilized everything that he was going to use.
Right. They set up a separate part of the restaurant, and even the other patrons that were there were all undercovers.
Yeah.
In this one little separate part, which it was apart from the main part. And that's where they set up to do it. And like you said, they went in there and cleaned up everything. Even the detectives and the cold case guys went in there and cleaned everything themselves to make sure it was perfect.
They were going to try to get this guy's DNA.
Yeah, because they thought maybe we got one shot at it.
Yeah.
So let's see what we can do.
That's right. And he comes in, and he has his daughter with him. Yeah.
And they're like, oh, shit.
What do we do?
Do they know? Does he know? Are we busted?
Yeah, but they were sitting out in the parking lot watching him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm sure they were talking back and forth.
Oh,
what do we do?
Yeah.
So he comes in with his kid.
Let's go with it.
Yeah.
He's a 15-year-old daughter at this point.
So they sit down at the table, and they ordered hamburgers.
Yeah.
The Miller and his daughter ordered hamburgers.
Yeah, all three of them.
Yeah, and he said when he got his burger, he ate it in like five bites.
Yeah.
Just gulped it down and didn't drink anything.
They're like sweating because, wait, we ain't going to get anything on this.
That's what they were thinking. And he even asked him, can I get you something else to drink?
You don't want that water?
He had water. And he finally did take a couple of drinks of water out of his out of his cup, his mug.
Right.
What they give you at Chili's, those mugs, plastic mugs. Yeah.
And so they were there about an hour going through this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Trying to sell that job to get him to be this fake security guard.
Yep.
Yeah.
And just hoping to get the DNA.
Mm-hmm. But the interview left, and they were able to get some DNA off his glass.
Yes. Yeah, they took the glass, pulled it out, and sent it off.
Yep. And the DNA came back to him.
It did.
And it matched Brian Patrick Miller.
Yes, it did.
To the killer.
They were in a meeting, right? And said the whole the lab came in, busted the door up, and said, that's your man.
Hey, they got him.
We got him.
Yep. Sure did. And they went to his work at the Amazon warehouse and arrested him.
Yep. So basically went in and picked him up, and he acted like he had no idea why he was in trouble.
No. He didn't have no clue.
So they told him that during the interview, the detectives were telling him that they had some DNA linking him to the Canal murders. And he said, I don't know how that's possible. It can't be me.
Yeah, he was in his interview saying he just hates the sight of blood.
Yeah.
So they leave him in there, and they leave him in the investigation room or the interrogation room, whatever it's called. He starts playing a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, he acts like he's crazy talking to himself.
Yeah.
Because he knows they're recording him.
Right.
Yeah. And he's going to try to use that later as an insanity.
This is when he starts coming up with this. There's two different Brian Patrick Millers.
He has like a multiple personality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One, it was the brain had split everything in two. So one was the good guy, one was the bad guy. So he basically didn't, cutting off all the memories from all the terrible stuff his mother had done to him.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had the regular guy and then the one that didn't remember anything, apparently.
That's right. But Miller pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity at his trial.
Mm-hmm.
And it began in April of 2021, which is not long ago. And his defense team argued that he suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder due to his abusive childhood. And he also had a dissociative identity disorder, which caused him to have those multiple personalities that we talked about.
Now, when investigators got ready to go to his house, boy, they were in for it then, weren't they?
Yeah.
Before all the defense and all that shit started.
But they radioed, said they're going in. They couldn't even get in.
Yeah, they couldn't get in.
Mm-mm.
It's basically, the house looks like a episode of horror or something.
Yeah.
And
we got a couple of pictures of inside the house, and it's a mess.
It's basically, they just said, you can't get in the door. It's full of crap. So there was basically a path to go to the bathroom, to the kitchen, and where the TV was, and that was it.
Yeah. Everything and he lived there with his 14-year-old daughter, too.
Mm-hmm.
But when they got in there and started looking, man, they found some creepy stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, they did. They found a lot of pornographic stuff, violent pornographic stuff, videos of women being beheaded.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they don't think it was even a picture of a severed head on his...
on the refrigerator.
Yeah.
And at first I'm thinking, maybe it was just from Friday 13th Part 2 or something. But I don't think so.
No, they found a lot of creepy stuff in his house.
Yes.
And they said that one of his personalities was named Jason. And this Jason was responsible for the murders of Angela and Melanie.
But he said he didn't remember any of that.
No.
It couldn't have been him.
Like you talked about his brain splitting.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had no memory.
Yeah. They went through the entire house. Can you imagine how long it took them to go through that?
I wouldn't have wanted to do it at all, but no. I can't imagine.
They have to go through it. But I don't think they didn't find nothing. They didn't find the murder weapons. They didn't find not even the bicycles.
Yeah, nothing related to the girls.
Uh-uh. Mm-mm. But you also got to think, that would have been years ago, and then they moved to Washington and then moved back. And then when he split up with his wife, and then this had to be a whole new horde. I mean, he's not taking that stuff everywhere. So that would make sense why they didn't really find anything.
They probably throwed stuff away.
Well, they'd have to. He done moved three times.
Yeah. Yeah, but the prosecution disputed his insanity claim and presented evidence that Miller was sane and aware of his actions.
Yeah, they think it was a bunch of baloney.
And they even showed videos of him hunting zombies and talking about serial killers.
Mm-hmm.
And demonstrated his preoccupation with violence and death. And they also showed testimony from his ex-wife, Amy, who said that he was abusive and controlling during their marriage.
Oh, yeah.
So he had his wits about him.
Yeah.
I don't see how they could do the insanity plea at all.
No. And I don't think the judge is buying it either.
No.
I mean, because they had, what do you call that trial?
A judge trial. I mean, it wasn't no jury.
Yeah.
Trial by judge.
Yeah.
And her name was Judge Suzanne Cohen.
Mm-hmm.
And it was on June the 7th of 2021. The bench trial began without a jury, and Miller was found guilty of two counts of first-degree murder, kidnapping, and attempted sexual assault.
Yeah, and on this bench trial, she was basically judge, jury, and executioner here because she gets to do everything. She does the sentencing and everything.
Yeah, and she even rejected his insanity defense and ruled that he was eligible for the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that he did not just murder them. He brutalized them, and he evaded capture for over 20 years.
Yep.
Yeah. So on the next day, June the 8th of 2021, Judge Cohen sentenced Miller to death for his crimes.
Sure did.
And she also sentenced him to 7 years in prison for kidnapping and 5 years for attempted sexual assault in relation to each victim.
Hmm.
And she hoped that her sentence would bring closure to the families of the victims and justice to the community. And man, she didn't hold back.
No. You know, it said that when she came out there and she started to give her her verdict and her punishment, she's, you know, started talking about some stuff and, you know, about his background, and she made a big pause and everybody was just holding her breath because they thought she was going to go lenient, but she went far the other way.
She did. Yeah. As far as you could go.
Yeah. You haven't known that.
But now Miller is now in his 50s and he sits on death row at the Iman prison complex in Florence, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He still maintains his innocence, though. He said he didn't do it.
That's what he says.
Still says he didn't do it.
But when asked to explain how his DNA was found on both crime scenes, he said that's a question that will go unanswered.
He's like, that's the million-dollar question. If I knew that, I wouldn't be sitting here, would I?
Yeah.
Basically saying he misses spending time with his daughter and his friends and going to car shows and events.
Yeah, but he's on death row.
It's pretty crazy. So it's pretty wild that happened that far back. And I mean, there was a couple other cases that they say that they thought he did too.
Yeah,
been back.
One of them was Brandy Myers.
Yeah,
she was like a 12 or 13 year old little girl that was going door to door.
Mm-hmm.
And
she's either selling spots on a book of readathon or selling magazines or something. I'm not sure. It was conflicting information there.
Going door to door.
Yeah, but her and one of her friends were going door to door, and they decided to split up so they could cover more ground.
Yeah, but the last time she was spotted was two houses down from Miller's house.
Right.
Yeah.
And his ex-wife would later say that he actually told her at one time that he killed that girl and pulled her in, killed her, cut her up, and got rid of her in the trash with trash bags at random times.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's just hearsay, but that's what she said that she told him.
But they're pretty convinced that he killed that little girl.
Yeah, because
they can't prove it.
It's never been solved. They ain't never found him. So. And then there was another one, Shannon Amok.
Shannon Amok.
Yeah. And she was another teenager that was killed.
Yeah, but it can't relate to him at all. Can't connect him at all.
No, there wasn't enough evidence to put it on him.
Yeah. So there's no telling how many other murders or crimes he's committed.
Yeah, because, you know, at least he stabbed that one girl when he did move away, so he was already married him.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's not like he got better. So I'm sure there's a lot other stuff going on here.
Yeah.
This is about those two girls long ago, and then how the DNA advanced enough to get him.
To be able to. This is probably one of the first cases.
And that woman smart enough to take that genealogy and twist it around and basically back search it backward, a reverse search. That's what I'm trying to say.
That's what she did.
Yeah. Which would be the same technology that got the Golden State Killer, which would be 5 years later.
That's right.
Yeah. So it's really, this case is really sets the precedent for the DNA and how it's used in solving these cold cases.
Because it was related, the way she found it was when his brother was arrested. And they connected him to his brother. Mm-hmm. That's where they got that from.
Right.
So it's pretty impressive, man.
Very much so.
But that Colleen Fitzpatrick, she's a go-getter.
Yeah, she's the one who busted this thing wide open.
Yeah. So they've done good, man.
So doing with her and Schwarzkopf, teaming up and being set to really try to solve these murders. But anyway, he still says he didn't do it. But
now, Brian Patrick Miller is one of the most notorious serial killers in Arizona history. He killed two young women in brutal and sadistic manner and escaped detection for more than 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
He also lived a double life as a zombie hunter and a serial killer, hiding his dark secrets behind a mask.
It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. But he is sentenced to death by lethal injection.
Mm.
Whenever that comes.
Probably another 20 years.
Probably. But that is the story of Brian Patrick Miller, the zombie hunter.
The zombie hunter.
Yep. All right, Dale, we're going to get out of here.
Let's roll.
All right, we want everyone to be safe. Please be careful and always be aware of your surroundings.
Because the next episode could be about you.
This is the Crack House Chronicles.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.